First case for argument is Musser versus Gentiva. Mr. Roby.
Thank you, sir. Good morning. May it please the court. My name is Dan Roby from Fort Wayne, Indiana. I am the attorney for the appellants Michael and Michelle Musser. Their case comes to you by way of diversity from the Northern District of Indiana, and it involves the tragic and preventable death of their 18-month-old son, Maverick. Maverick was dependent for breathing purposes on a tracheotomy tube, which was inserted into his mouth down his throat, and the tube would occasionally become dislodged or blocked, in which case he would need immediate nursing care to restore his airway or he could die.
Mr. Roby, yes. Was it possible for Maverick to breathe at all without the trachea tube? In other words, was respiratory arrest a certain result once Maverick decannulated?
Yes, at this point in time. There was a time earlier that he was not on a CPAP 24 hours a day. At the time of his death, however, he was, Your Honor.
Thank you.
What was his prognosis?
His prognosis was pretty good. When you read the testimony of Dr. Smith and the exhibit from Gentiva's supervising nurse, Barbara Cromer, we see that the child had a pretty good prognosis and had indeed lived 18 months, having been born very prematurely at about 22
was
weeks.
Was he going to get better, or would he always be...
According to Dr. Smith, he probably would have gotten much better and would have eventually been removed from the breathing apparatus. However, no one can be certain of that outcome, Judge. It is Dr. Smith's opinion that he had a good prognosis, and that is in his testimony in the record.
Mr. Roby, did Dr. Smith speak with Dawn Kinzer to get the details of Maverick's death
prior
to filing out the death certificate?
He did not, Judge. He was, as you are aware, under 24-hour nursing care provided for a fee by the appellee, Gentiva.
What would have been the method of CPR performed on a first child in this condition?
An ambu bag and standard CPR as it is performed pediatrically. There is a question of fact as to whether Nurse Kinzer was qualified in that regard.
Well, what did you say, ambu bag?
Ambu.
Ambu, what's that?
That's a bag that with a mask you put over the face and squeeze the bag to get air into the lungs of the child. And that
wouldn't be electrical.
No, not electrical.
Was the notion that his heart had stopped, or that he just wasn't breathing, or
the contention in this case?
I mean, what is the CPR for? Is it?
Oh, the CPR is to restore a heartbeat, and to eventually restore breathing as a measure to temporarily resuscitate the child so they can get him to the hospital, and that must be administered very quickly. Time is, of course, of the essence.
But his heart had actually stopped? Is that...
It is my understanding that that had already occurred at that point in time.
Wouldn't it have been awfully easy for you, or whoever the trial lawyer was, if it wasn't you, to have qualified expert witnesses, either the doctor or a nurse, rather than rely on the mother and on the doctor as occurrence witnesses?
Well, we felt, Your Honor, that the best expert in the case was Dr. William Smith, who was his treating pediatric pulmonary specialist. And he's the doctor that we primarily relied upon, and his testimony was given by way of deposition, as the court is aware. Also, the deposition of Dr. Harvey Beeler, was taken, another of the treating physicians, in which Dr. Beeler testified that the child had anecdotal history of resuscitation and probably could have been resuscitated on this particular occasion had Nurse Kinzer intervened properly and appropriately.
But isn't that expert testimony, that is, what would have happened if Kinzer had acted more quickly? I mean, Schmidt, he was left to just speculate, wasn't he, about...
Well, I'd hardly call it speculation, Your Honor. The child had an anecdotal history of many prior occasions where he'd gone into respiratory arrest, and with prompt and appropriate nursing attention, he was always resuscitated when in the care of a nurse.
Yeah, but if you look at what Schmidt said, I'm looking at, this is quoted repeatedly in the briefs.
Yes.
I happen to be looking at page 24 of the Appley's brief. He said, Dr. Smith, he had a discussion with the mother, and she feels strongly that Maverick was neglected. And then he goes on and says, she felt the nurse who was there was not watching Maverick. And you know, it almost stands to reason, etc., if you have a nurse stand. That looks as if he's not testifying from his personal knowledge. He's testifying as a physician, given an opinion on the basis of, let's say, not his direct experience, but what he's heard and so on, which is fine for experts to do. But they're supposed to be, you know, qualified as experts, submit a report, and I don't understand why that wasn't done here.
Well, in that particular quote that the court is alluding to, if you go forward with it, it says that if they would have implemented some sort of intervention that would improve things, which had historically been the case, that if intervention occurred with Maverick in a timely fashion, he was resuscitated. We are relying upon the anecdotal history of resuscitation as an inference that he would have been resuscitated on this occasion as well.
Mr. Ruby, I'd like to sort of add on to what Judge Posner said, because of course Dr. Smith wasn't there observing the baby.
Correct.
Nor was he supervising the nurse. So I want you to, if you can, explain to me how his opinion regarding the cause of Maverick's death was in the nature of a treating physician.
Let me first say that the focus in this case should not be upon the cause of death or the cause of decannulation or respiratory arrest. It should be on whether the child could have been resuscitated had Nurse Kinzer acted promptly and appropriately. The anecdotal history shows that the nurses who did act promptly and appropriately always resulted in resuscitation of the child. In addition to that, we have the testimony of Dr. Harvey Beeler, which is quoted at pages 70 to 72 of document 93, I believe it is, in which he was asked, in your experience, what is the general success of bagging a patient going through a BPD spell? And he said, generally pretty good. And he goes on to say, but obviously early recognition is key and will increase the likelihood of reversing the situation.
Help me with this, please. It seems that under Indiana law, in order to establish a prima facie case of medical malpractice, a plaintiff has to provide expert testimony in order to show that the negligent act was the proximate cause of the plaintiff's injuries. You know,
that's
I mean, you look at this and you say to yourself, do we really need Dr. Smith's testimony if it's undisputed that Nurse Kinzer didn't know how to replace a tracheotomy tube, she didn't know how to perform CPR on infant. She didn't properly check the stock to ensure that there was a syringe available for emergencies. And, you know, automatically you think of res ipsa loquitur, but under Indiana law, we have, you know, this, what seems to me to be a rather unusual situation.
Well, first of all, let me emphasize that it is a nursing negligence case and not a physician negligence case. And the record is replete with the testimony of the other two nurses, as well as Nurse Kinzer herself, saying what the nursing standards were. And couple that then with the anecdotal history of the resuscitation of the child on many prior occasions.
But the other two nurses, they weren't designated as expert witnesses, were they?
No, they were not. They were not. Again, they were treating nurses, and we believe this is a 26A2A situation. If it is, then the case should be treated as one in which only the identity of the witnesses need to be disclosed according to the wording of the rule, and no particular form is expressed for that disclosure. And certainly the taking of their depositions more than fulfilled that.
How would all that fit into Patel in your view?
Into Patel?
Yeah, Patel versus Gaze.
I'm sorry, I cannot answer that.
Well, that's a Seventh Circuit case that stated that the physician acquires an opinion about the correct duty of care directly through her treatment of the patient. She doesn't have to be identified as an expert, but if her testimony goes beyond the substantive and temporal scope of the treatment of the patient, then it enters the realm of expert testimony, and the expert has to be disclosed under Rule 26.
Well, certainly the treating nurses are testifying from their own experience of resuscitating this child in the past. And that is anecdotal history, which we believe causes those nurses to fall within 26A2A rather than A2B, and their depositions having been taken. The only two reported cases on that are Heidelberger and Brandon, in which it was held that exclusion of the witnesses would be improper under those circumstances.
But you'd think it would be desirable to have an expert on this respiratory ailment who would testify about success in resuscitation in general and how long this child had been in respiratory, how long before it was noticed was he, you know, in cardiac arrest, and
in retrospect,
you really have his mother testifying as a medical expert.
Well, we're not relying on the mother's testimony so much as we are Dr. Smith's and Dr. Beeler with regard to the inferences to be drawn by the anecdotal history.
You see, for one thing, it may be that by the time the trach tube fell out, it may have been too late to resuscitate a Maverick, right? Depending on how long he had been.
That is exactly correct.
And if that's true, that would mean all you would be left with as negligence that had a causal consequence would be the setting of the alarm, some defect in the alarm. And wouldn't you need an expert about how good those alarms are, where they always work, you know? And
no, our focus at that point, Your Honor, would be on the failure to properly monitor this child and to recognize when he was in respiratory.
Right, but how, if the child is just lying there, how do you know if the alarm doesn't go off that he stopped breathing?
He was, first of all, lying on his stomach and should not have been so placed. And he was lying right next to the nurse who, in our opinion, failed to properly observe him. And had she done so, she would have recognized and should have recognized the respiratory arrest in enough time.
Why would she have recognized? What would she have seen?
She would have seen that the child was not breathing.
Well, ordinarily when you look at a person, you don't notice whether the person is breathing or not.
Well,
are these nurses actually supposed to be watching this child for an 8-hour stretch, watching to make sure that they can, that the nurse can see that he is breathing?
That's correct.
That doesn't sound logical.
If he has any of the alarms disconnected, and we know it's undisputed that the apnea alarm was disconnected, and there is a dispute of fact as to whether the alarm that was attached to his foot was connected or not, because when he was brought to the hospital, he had his shoes and socks on. She said it was attached, and our contention is that it was not. The CPAP alarm was attached. For some reason, she says it didn't go off. A strange finding.
Did an expert look at the alarm to see if it was defective? What happened to the alarm?
The alarms were placed back in service, and
were never tested.
They were tested by the company that supplied the alarms. They were found to be in working order and placed back in service.
Mm-hmm.
Thank you.
Okay, thank you, Mr. Conover.
Thank you, Your Honor. May it please the court. My name is Garrett Conover, and along with Robert Kopka, we represent Gentiva Health Services in this matter. The central issue in this case is whether the district court abused its discretion when it excluded the Musser's proffered expert testimony offered in opposition to the motion for summary judgment.
Mr. Conover, you know, you state that had Dr. Smith been designated as an expert, Gentiva could have proceeded differently at his deposition. Can you give us a more specific example of a line of questioning you would have followed in the deposition had you known Dr. Smith was testifying as an expert rather than as the treating physician?
We agree with the district court's analysis in that regard. A line of questioning with regard to the factual underpinnings of the what has been put forth as his expert opinion in that regard would have certainly been much more extensive and undertaken. Aside from that, his analysis with regard to the cause of death and the proximate cause between any action or inaction on the part of Nurse Kinzer and the ultimate death of the child would have been much more extensively examined.
Did you have any expert witnesses listed?
We did, Your Honor, and they were divulged at the time and on deadline as set by the district court. If this court rules in favor of the Musters on this...
What was your theory, or found, just can you ask your expert's theory on what happened to the child?
Our expert found this child to be in a declining state of health, and that's borne out by his medical records. The fact is, just a few weeks before this occurrence, he had been hospitalized, and that was Dr. Beeler's opportunity to see this child for the first time. And the medical record is replete with respiratory arrests and similar circumstances. In fact, the child was very recent to this occasion, ordered on 24-hour CPAP, whereas in previous months, he had not been in that diagnosis. But if this court rules in favor of the Mussers, it would hold that it is an abuse of discretion to exclude undisclosed expert testimony when a party...
What about Judge Roedner's suggestion that this case has the flavor of res ipsa loquitur? That is, if you have these alarms, which are in working order, and they don't go off when he stops breathing, isn't the inference that the nurse had turned them off?
The inferences raised in res ipsa loquitur, I think, are superseded by Indiana common law. The district court held that in the Narducci case, an expert is always necessary, except in a very rare circumstance, to establish a prima facie case of medical negligence in Indiana. That is the law that applies to the facts of this case, and res ipsa was not pled. And we believe that the Narducci example that is cited in the district court's opinion would be controlling. If this court rules that it is an abuse of discretion to exclude expert testimony when initial disclosures are made and attendance at deposition takes place, it would create an exception that would virtually swallow the mandatory requirements, disclosure requirements, of Trial Rule 26A2.
Did this case go through the medical malpractice process of pre-trial, pre-litigation mediation?
It did not. Gentiva was not a participant in that statutory scheme. The district court found that it was both unjustified not to disclose these experts, and their failure to disclose expert was also harmful.
You know, you claimed in the brief that without the identification of Mrs. Musser as an expert, you were unable to develop the factual and scientific basis for her opinion that Maverick had been in cardiac arrest for over 20 minutes. But nothing, it seems to me, was stopping you from questioning her further about the basis of this claim during the deposition, was it?
There was no impediment to the line of questioning. However, notice of an expert is something that assists a deposing party in formulating questions to the specific issues. In order to mount a sufficient Daubert challenge, it would be essential to know that somebody is being presented as an expert pathologist when they are simply their deposition testimony simply goes to their expertise as a nurse.
Are you aware of any cases in which a parent in a case such as this has been designated as an expert?
There's certainly none cited in the brief and none to my knowledge. The district court found, tracking the provisions of Rule 37, that the actions of the Musters in regard to non-disclosure of their experts were unjustified. And in fact, there is no effective argument put forth that there was justification for their failure to disclose experts.
Once Gentiva became aware that the Musters intended to use Dr. Smith as an expert, why didn't Gentiva seek an extension of discovery to redepose Dr. Smith?
The record is clear on this point. Musters have never made a disclosure of experts, belated or at any other time.
Are you saying that you never became aware that they intended to use Dr. Smith as an expert?
Only in their response to the motion for summary judgment was Dr. Smith's first proffered as an expert with regard to any issue in this case.
Your summary judgment was based on the fact there was no medical expert testimony to support the malpractice claim.
That's correct. Aside from that, the greater harm that was found by the district court was that even when this evidence is evaluated, it is insufficient to raise a material issue of fact. The court mentioned the precise testimony that's heavily relied upon by the Mussers, the testimony of Dr. Smith, where he seems to be making commentary with regard to Michelle Musser's opinions that there must have been negligence, and then goes into a small correlation with the child's medical history. But later on, in the same deposition, when asked specifically whether resuscitation is an exact science, whether it is always successful, he admits that it is not.
I have to say this. I asked you, you know, how you would question Dr. Smith differently. It just seems to me a very strange legal strategy to hold back on some questions because a witness has not been identified, as an expert witness. I still would like to know what you would have asked that you didn't ask.
The specific scientific and factual underpinnings of his opinion and an expansion on his rather tenuous opinion or commentary with regard to causation would have been a very specific focus of a line of questioning had we been aware that Dr. Smith was being proffered as...
Give me an example of a question that you didn't ask that you would have asked, if you can do that in hindsight.
Doctor, isn't it true that no blood testing or cardiac enzyme testing was done on this child? Wasn't it true? Wouldn't it be true that an autopsy would have revealed a specific or given us clues as to the amount of time the child had been in cardiac arrest? Isn't it true that specific information can be gathered from the monitors themselves, which could give us information that was not gathered?
Well, of course, you did ask upon what facts did you base your certification that the respiratory failure occurred within minutes of his death, and the answer was, well, one can't, survive much longer than a few minutes from respiratory arrest. So where would those questions have gotten you?
Well, that line of questioning that was cited goes to what observations were made in the course of his treatment. And we were dealing with
that. He's not there.
He just signed a death certificate. And that line of questioning goes to the death certificate where he opines only that the respiratory and cardiac arrest was secondary to bronchopulmonary dysplasia.
Since the change in the medical malpractice law in Indiana, have there been any malpractice claims that succeeded without expert testimony?
There are rare circumstances where, for example, a medical device or a forceps or whatever are left in a patient where it is clear that there has been some failure in the medical procedures. But other than that, the case law cited in our brief is very specific that expert testimony is required in medical negligence cases.
This case proceeded as a medical negligence case.
It did. It was pled in that manner. There was a greater harm, however, that is apparent on this record and is commented by the district court. The greater harm is proceeding to a trial on such tenuous evidence, a trial that must only end in a directed verdict, is a greater harm than even the inability of a particular lawyer to ask a particular question in a particular deposition. The greater harm that is apparent on this record and commented on it by the district court was the fact that there was virtually no evidence of a proximate link between the death of the child and
excuse me, but will you concede that Nurse Kinzer didn't know how to replace a tracheotomy tube? Will you concede that she didn't know how to perform CPR on an infant? Will you concede that she did not properly check the stop to ensure that there was a syringe available for emergencies?
Taking them one by one, we would concede that Nurse Kinzer's testimony was that she had not herself replaced a trachea tube, but had participated in the replacement of trachea tubes on several occasions. The second point, I believe, was whether she did not know how to perform CPR. That her testimony would have been, or was, that she did perform CPR. Michelle Musser criticized her performance of the CPR, indicating that her hands should be slightly higher on the child's chest during the chest compression feature of that procedure. So there are issues of fact, but each element of a claim of medical malpractice must be accompanied by expert testimony, and there is no evidence. The district court found no evidence that there was any expert testimony with regard to to a proximate link between the actions or inactions of Nurse Kinzer and the death of the child. It may well be the case that Dr. Smith admitted that respiratory efforts, no matter how perfectly performed, may indeed not have been effective on a child with the severity of bronchopulmonary dysplasia that this child had. And that is the greater harm that is found by the district court when it comments on this evidence.
Let me follow up. The way you proceed when examining an expert witness, does that change because it's an expert witness? Even though you have a physician who's not an expert and a physician who is an expert, does your questioning change?
It would change, especially if we had been provided with the requisite report under 26A2B. That would outline a physician's background and history, his testimony in previous cases, and his specific opinion with regard to each of the essential elements of this claim.
What about the opinions of non-experts? Can you ask that?
It's certainly gone into in depositions that I have conducted in order to get a feel, a background for the case. Those questions are not undertaken, however, to try to flesh out an expert opinion, which should be divulged by the other side under the district court's order. And this court should remember that there was an extension of time granted to the Mussers to divulge their experts. The court's order of June 22, 2002 extended the time under which they should divulge experts. And to this date, the record is clear that they have never divulged an expert. They have proffered expert testimony without ever having complied with the district court's scheduling order or trial rule 26A2.
Okay, thank you, Mr. Conover.
Thank you.
Mr. Roby, how much time? Oh, you don't have any time, but you can have a minute or two for rebuttal if you'd like.
Thank you, Your Honor.
Shouldn't there have been expert testimony about these alarms? How you should set them and whether they're... I mean, you know, with the airport search business, if you set the alarm... If you make it too sensitive, then it's always set off. And so we don't really know anything about how one sets these alarms, do we?
Well, we know it is the duty of the nurse in charge of the child to set them at an appropriate.
I know, but we don't know what's appropriate, right? We don't know whether the appropriate level is one that would always catch a respiratory problem, or whether if it's set at too sensitive a level, then it goes off every 3 minutes.
Well, the O2 oxygen.
It'd be very simple for you. I don't understand. I mean, puzzling about this case. There are a lot of questions. It would have been extremely easy, I would have thought, for you to have had an expert who would have testified about the management of this illness, which involves nurse care, alarms, CPR, and so on.
That is correct, Your Honor. We assumed that Dr. Smith's testimony was adequate in that regard.
But you're faced, and as Judge Kenney has reminded, you're faced with this Indiana rule. You're supposed to have expert testimony.
Again, keep
it... I would think that the first thing in a medical malpractice case in Indiana is you go out and hire an expert.
As far as the nursing negligence aspect, we were relying upon the testimony of the other nurses.
But nobody was qualified as an expert. Now, obviously, you can have experts on nursing care.
The nurses were qualified as experts on the nursing care aspect. I'm sure Your Honor is interested in the...
You mean they submitted reports?
They did not submit reports. They did not submit
reports. We have to submit a report. Get an expert. The expert submits a report. The report has to summarize what testimony the expert is going to give, and then that gives the other side information it can use to... guide its own experts.
If these are 26A2A witnesses, as we argue that they are, Then the Martin versus CSX case, which we cited to the court as an additional authority, decided after the briefing of this case, points out that there is a split of authority among the district courts in the Seventh Circuit.
Well, it doesn't matter how the district courts split.
And that this court has not specifically addressed that issue as to whether these are 26A2As or Bs.
Well, what's the difference?
The 26A2A witness, the only requirement of the rule is that their identity be disclosed, and certainly the taking of their depositions more than fulfilled that. The appellee was present to cross-examine and did indeed retain its own experts to refute the testimony. To say and that they were unaware that this was expert testimony flies in the face of the fact that they retained their own experts, Drs. Rathman and Phillips, to refute the testimony of our expert witnesses.
How demanding is the Indiana case law with regard to proffering expert witnesses to support medical negligence claims?
Well, admittedly, there is a requirement that there be expert testimony. The Indiana cases, interestingly, do not deal with nursing negligence. These are cases that deal with physician negligence. There is a requirement, however, we concede that we would have to show that there is at least an inference that had the nurse acted promptly and appropriately, this child could have been resuscitated. And we rely upon the anecdotal history of that for that inference in this case. No one can say for sure whether this child could have been resuscitated. All we can say is that he always was in the past with prompt and appropriate nursing care, and we believe that he could have been in this case as well. And of course, all inferences must be drawn in favor of the Mussers, and when you draw those inferences, we feel that we've at least raised sufficient genuine issues of material fact to withstand summary judgment.
Okay, well, thank you very much.
Thank you.
Thank you to both parties. Move on to our